Welcome to Single Malt History with Gareth Russell, pouring out your serving of pure, distilled, intoxicating, and occasionally delicious history. Today we are discussing Margaret Beaufort, who is either notorious or forgotten, depending on your level of interest in Tudor history. A brief précis before we continue for those who might not be too familiar with the outline of Margaret's life. Born into the height of privilege and proximity to royal power in the 1440s, Margaret Beaufort was married when she was only 12 years old to Edmund Tudor, Earl of Richmond, King Henry VI's younger half-brother. As England slid into a brutal civil war known later as the Wars of the Roses, Margaret's husband was imprisoned, where he subsequently died from the plague, and their son, young Henry, was taken from his mother's care and later spirited to exile in Europe for his own safety when their family's enemies seized the English throne. Marrying a supporter of the new regime, Margaret was, however, later accused of working to destroy the royal line she had sworn to obey. Some claim that by fair means and increasingly foul means, she worked secretly to bring her son home, to make him king instead, stopping at nothing, including, quite possibly, the murder of two royal children. Others have counter-argued that Margaret could not possibly have foreseen what would happen until the coup of 1483, when King Richard III seized the throne from his nephew Edward V, who disappeared along with his younger brother, the two later being nicknamed the Princes in the Tower. And that subsequent attempts to identify Margaret or anybody else as the prince's killer is born from nothing more than a desire by Richard III's later sympathisers to exonerate him from the charge of taking both crown and life from his nephew. Whatever happened, the disappearance of the two princes shattered England's fragile political stability, threatening to restart the Civil War. As the last distant living relative of the deposed royal line of Lancaster, Margaret's son Henry Tudor raised an army in France, returned to his native Wales, from where he invaded England, defeating and killing Richard III. Becoming King Henry VII, he founded the Tudor dynasty, making his mother, Margaret, Countess of Richmond and Derby, matriarch of the monarchy, and one of the wealthiest women in Europe. But how far had she been prepared to go to make all that happen? Our guest today is Dr. Nicola Tallis, who is the host of the podcast Historical Gems, focusing on the history of jewellery and the jewellery of history. Nicola Tallis gained her doctorate on the English Queen's Jewellery with a thesis titled All the Queen's Jewels, 1445 to 1548. She is the author of three critically acclaimed biographies of the tragic nine-day Queen, Lady Jane Grey, the Elizabethan socialite Lettice, Countess of Leicester, and Henry VII's notorious mother, Margaret Beaufort. These biographies are respectively titled Crown of Blood, Elizabeth's Rival, and Uncrowned Queen. In the interest of full disclosure, I reviewed Uncrowned Queen for The Times, and I enjoyed it so much when I started this podcast, I knew I wanted to interview Dr. Tallis about her work on it, and if Margaret Beaufort really was as cold, manipulative, and even as murderous as we've been led to believe. Dr. Tallis, welcome to Single Malt History. Thank you so much for being here.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
No, I'm delighted. Thank you very much. So, Nicola, you've written about tragic women and charismatic women before in your biographies, but is it probably fair to say that you really haven't written about one as controversial as Margaret Beaufort until you released Uncrowned Queen? If you ask, for instance, on forums or any public media for people to name the worst person in the Tudor era, my experience and my shock is that there will nearly always be a handful of people who name Margaret Beaufort. The reason I'm shocked by the intensity or the certainty, I think, of that assertion, and you can please correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression is that if you look back to earlier generations, say even 30 to 50 years ago, to how Margaret Beaufort was presented in biographies and works of fiction, like the BBC TV drama Shadow of the Tower or novels by bestsellers like Jean Plady, you see Margaret being presented maybe as a bit pushy, a bit dour, a bit overprotective, a stickler for protocol, but not evil. And now she really is seen as someone who stopped at quite literally nothing to put her son on the throne and keep him there, regardless of the humanitarian cost. I mean, she's frequently described online as a child killer. What is it, do you think, that has seen her become a moral monster to a lot of modern readers?
I think it's a real shame that she's seen in that way now, to be honest. And I think that it has been, as you pointed out, it's something that's been heavily shaped by popular culture in recent years, particularly with the arrival of Philippa Gregory's The White Queen and The Red Queen as well. I think this has had a huge impact on shaping people's perceptions and on changing that impression of Margaret from being, as you rightly said, she was, or she has been depicted as being pushy and overbearing, which I do agree with to a certain extent, but there has certainly been a shift in that. And people, readers and viewers alike, have unfortunately got on board with that to a certain extent. And I do think it's a real shame, because actually when you look at the contemporary source material surrounding Margaret's life, and we're very lucky actually, because considering that Margaret was a woman living in the 15th century and the turn of the 16th century, there is quite an abundance of source material that we have, which is quite revealing in terms of her character, in terms of, you know, some of the important areas of her life. And there's nothing in any of these sources that supports this view of Margaret as being evil, of this view of Margaret as being wicked. I just think it's perhaps a bit of a novelist's impression that many readers and listeners have perhaps run with. But that's not actually based on anything sound in terms of contemporary sources.
I mean, I think we've definitely seen that happening with the power of popular culture. But one of the things that's so interesting, actually, because, yeah, I think you're probably right, that's such a good way to put it. There is like a disconnect between what we see in the sources and what we see in our imagination. And sometimes I think our imagination can be so vivid that, you know, for a lot of readers, it becomes sort of impossible to disentangle it. One of the things which you bring so well to life in Uncrowned Queen, and I loved this when I read it, was Margaret's background. She was born into, I think we can call, problem-prone privilege in a time of impending chaos for England. And I really did find, particularly the details you included about her father, the Duke of Somerset, fascinating. Can you tell us a little bit about that Duke of Somerset and his impact on his daughter's childhood?
Of course. So the Duke of Somerset, John Beaufort, was the grandson of John of Gaunt, the third son of Edward III. And he was a very interesting character. He had led this campaign in France during the reign of Henry VI, but unfortunately he hadn't distinguished himself in this at all. In fact, he created havoc, really, and he returned home to England in complete disgrace in 1444, the year after his daughter Margaret's birth. And As a result of this disgrace, he retired away from court to basically wait for the scandal that was surrounding him to die down. And that's when, very sadly for Margaret, John Beaufort died just a few days before her first birthday in May 1444. And some sources speculate or suggest that he'd died at his own hand, that he had committed suicide. And I think that there is possibly some truth in this. I think it's certainly a possibility, even though in the 15th century, suicide was considered to be a mortal sin. I think it's quite revealing that many of the sources are silent on the subject of John Beaufort's death. So I think that that's certainly suggestive that this may well have been the case, that he had committed suicide. So already, before she'd even turned a year old, Margaret was fatherless. And I think it's fair to say that even though she never knew her father, she was certainly proud to be his daughter and proud to be associated with him. And she was certainly very proud of her Beaufort blood. And, you know, this was something that she really took care to highlight later on in her life. And she also paid for later in life for her father to have a really wonderful tomb in Wimborne Minster in Dorset, which is still there today. It's a double tomb that he shares with his wife, Margaret's mother, Margaret Beecham. And it's quite a sweet memorial, actually. And I think one that is perhaps indicative of the way in which Margaret saw her parents' marriage, because mother and father are seen clasping hands, which is quite touching in many ways. So in physical terms, obviously, John Beaufort wasn't a part of Margaret's life. He wouldn't have been remembered by her. But as I say, I think she was certainly keen to be associated with him and very proud to be his daughter. But I also think that his death at such an early time in Margaret's life began to teach Margaret some important lessons about the unreliability of men in some ways, because again, you know, she's less than a year old when she loses her father. And this was to be a bit of a constant pattern throughout her life, that the male figures who were central and important in her life would in one way or another disappear. And I think that this began with her father.
That's so, I mean, it was just one of the things I find totally compelling when reading Uncrowned Queen, partly because I don't, you also have this idea of Margaret sort of, I mean, a bit like Athena, sort of, you know, like, you know, spreading forth fully formed. You don't really think of her as a child. And certainly when you made the point, in the book about, you know, the different, when you laid out the evidence about whether or not he killed himself, I thought that you really, I was convinced he had, certainly because it looks like Henry VI kind of intervened to help have Somerset buried in consecrated ground, which I find quite moving. And on all that subject, you handled in such a sensitive and sorrowful way what Margaret went through with her only pregnancy. She conceived at 12, not long after her wedding, and gave birth to her son, Henry Tudor, at 13. I mean, utterly horrific. How do you, as a historian, engage with things that are so painful and often deeply, profoundly horrible to write about?
It is hard. And I think, I'm sure, I don't know, you may feel the same, but I personally just have to detach myself from that, because I think it's so easy and so natural for us as historians and as readers, as researchers, to judge everything by 21st century standards. And as you said, it's completely horrific and abhorrent to think that Margaret was pregnant at 12 years old. And even by 15th century standards, you know, this wasn't necessarily common, even though the church decreed that 12 was the legal age at which a woman could cohabit with her husband. Many of Margaret's contemporaries still chose to wait for a few years before consummating marriages. So even by 15th century standards, yeah, getting pregnant at 12 wasn't exactly the norm. So it can be very, very difficult to read these sources and try and detach yourself from it. But I think that is the key. I think we have to try and remember that the 15th century was very different to the 21st century in so many ways. And you know, society and expectations were very different. And I think that is the key. You just have to try and stay that one step removed and remember that we can't really judge these people for the decisions that they made back then, because thoughts and feelings were so different. And I think you just have to try and remember again also that we didn't know these people. Yes, it's our responsibility to try and tell their story as faithfully and as objectively as we can, but we didn't know these people. So you do have to try and remove that element of emotional involvement. And I perhaps found it a bit more difficult to do with Margaret than I have with either of my previous books, because of the fact that, as you said, she was pregnant at such a young age. And it did certainly shape my views on her a bit more and make me look at her in a bit more of a human way, I suppose. And it does make you feel sympathetic to what she would have been through. But yeah, I think ultimately you just have to try and take all of the emotion out of it and just look at the facts, look at the story, and write it as objectionally as you can.
Yeah, I think that makes so much sense, actually. But you do kind of sometimes have to protect yourself a little bit, because sometimes these things can stay with you long after you've walked away from your desk. But it did, certainly, I mean, sort of the sheer physical fragility and toll that it took on her is very well documented in Uncrowned Queen. Just by way of a setup for the next question, I'll explain to some of our readers who maybe aren't overly familiar with the Russian roulette of a fortune's wheel that spun during the Wars of the Roses. After her marriage and her son's exile, Margaret established herself at the court of the new branding in the English monarchy, the Royal House of York, which then went into self-inflicted freefall when King Edward IV died in 1483. His adolescent son becomes Edward V for a few months before he's deposed and imprisoned by his uncle, who becomes Richard III. The ex-boy king then disappears, and it's widely assumed at the time and after that Uncle Richard took the boy's throne, so why not his life? But then we have this pervasive conspiracy theory that emerges, I think, first over 100 years or so, briefly afterwards, and then really takes off in the 20th century, that Margaret Beaufort, while a courtier, somehow had the ex-boy king and his little brother killed, so that it would damage King Richard III, weaken the Yorkist cause, and pave the way for many Yorkist supporters to abandon Richard III if he was framed for the prince's murders, and pledge their allegiance to Margaret's son Henry Tudor as a sort of retaliation. In Uncrowned Queen, you are, I think, quite rightly unsparing in your rinsing of that version of events. You state quite firmly, which I enjoyed, that it's impossible that Margaret had anything to do with the deaths of Edward V and his little brother. And yet that really is the thing frequently, as if not provable, then certainly possible, presented as the foundation stone of the evil Margaret Beaufort, which we're offered today. Why do you think we can know beyond a shadow of a doubt that she had nothing to do with their disappearance?
When I began researching Margaret's life, this was one of the things that most intrigued me. And I have always subscribed to the view that Richard III was responsible for the disappearance of his nephews. But when I came to write Margaret's story, it was really important to me, given the speculation around, was it her? Could it have been her? Was she evil? Was she this child murderer? It was really important to me to go back and re-examine the evidence and see if I'd missed something, basically. I really wanted to approach this question objectively because, as you say, it's such a pivotal part of why Margaret has gained this evil reputation. And so I just wanted to see, if I'd missed something and where it had all come from. But I do genuinely believe that there's no way that Margaret could have been involved whatsoever, because there is not one shred of contemporary evidence that links her with the disappearance of Edward V and his brother. And to me, this is the most compelling evidence of her innocence, because I think that had there been any whisper or any kind of any the smallest hint of her involvement, then there would have been some mention of it in some contemporary source. And so the fact that there's nothing, I think, is highly indicative that we can rule her out. Mm-hmm. And as you said, the first indication or first suggestion that she had been involved and that she had killed them doesn't come until about a century after her death. So I think, to be perfectly honest, yes, you could argue that at some point she had motive to kill the princes, although I would also argue that this goes against everything that we know about her character, but she certainly didn't have the means, or certainly not during Richard III's lifetime anyway. So I genuinely think that there's nothing at all. And I believe me, I have looked, I've delved into this, I've tried to get to the bottom of this, but there's nothing to link her with their disappearance whatsoever.
I felt for you. I mean, I thought you dealt with it so well in On Crown Queen, and I felt for you. I mean, I think I just finished a book on maybe it was a bit before, on the Titanic, and there are certain conspiracy theories there that you are baffled at their tenacity, I think, is probably the most tactful way I can put that. So, Nicola, what is your impression of Margaret Beaufort after years of researching her and writing her story? Who was she?
I think that Margaret has had a very, very bad time in recent years. And again, you know, when I did come to write this book, I wasn't thinking to myself, okay, well, it's my job as the historian to rehabilitate her. It's my job to make her look good. That wasn't my intention at all. I literally wanted to study the sources and to see where that took me and what impression I gleaned of her. And I think that actually we can see, largely from her account books, there are loads of her account books that survive in the archives at St. John's College in Cambridge, which was of her foundation. And I think from these we can glean real genuine insights into Margaret's personality. And we see from these a woman who was very, very pious and religious. And again, we can see that from the surviving portraits that we have of her. She was someone who also cared very deeply about her family, about her friends, about her servants. I mean, her household absolutely adored her. They doted on her, and she was extremely generous to them. And, you know, she was always giving alms to the poor. She was, on one occasion, she paid the debts of a priest who was in jail. She was also a woman who really loved the finer things in life. And that's something that I think that is perhaps overlooked when it comes to Margaret, because again, her portraits don't do her any favours in some ways, but she was a woman who loved fine clothes. So she had dresses that were made of purple velvet. She liked tawny colours as well. She loved crimson. She liked perfume, she loved red and white wine, and she was also a woman who really loved to be entertained. And this is something that I really loved about Margaret. I think it does show a real human side to her character, because she had two fools, one of whom was named Skip, and Margaret often paid for his clothes. He often had new clothes, and she also paid for them to be washed and laundered. She also paid for his special high-heeled shoes, and which I quite like. So those appear quite regularly. So I suspect that she kept him busy. And she also, when Skip, presumably Skip died because his name disappears and he's then replaced with a fool who I think is quite cruelly nicknamed Reginald the Idiot.
Oh, they're such a hideously like unsubtle generation, aren't they?
They really are. They really are. But yeah, she loved playing cards. She loved playing chess. She quite often placed bets on the outcomes of games of chess. So again, we're sort of seeing this other side of Margaret than the one that has traditionally been portrayed. So one that is less serious and more fun loving. So that was really quite heartwarming in some ways. I really enjoyed, I felt in some ways like I was getting to know Margaret Boffin, almost like I was a fly on the wall, which was quite nice. But then she was human in the same way that we all are. She had the same flaws, so she was by no means perfect. So even though I found myself feeling quite fond of Margaret, I'm not going to sit here and say, yeah, she's absolutely perfect, we mustn't criticize her, you know, because she could be quite ruthless on occasion. She was a stickler for debts. She never missed a trick, and I can imagine that she could have been quite annoying on occasion, actually, because yeah. You know, if you owed her something, she was like a dog with a bone, and she wouldn't let go until she had what she felt was her due, or until she'd been repaid. So I think that there were many things to love about her and to admire about her. But by the same token, as I say, she was far from perfect. But, you know, to me, that just makes her even more real, I suppose. She really came alive to me, and in many ways she wasn't just a woman who lived and existed 500 years ago. She was a woman who I feel we can get a genuine, true feel of her character and her personality.
Well, that, I mean, really does come out in Uncrowned Queen. She emerged in more than two dimensions.
Thank you.
Well, no, it was such a pleasure to read it. Lastly, can you tell us what you're working on at the moment, and where in the battlefields and hinterlands of social media our listeners can find you?
Yeah, of course. So I'm currently working on turning my PhD thesis into a book.
Joyful. I love that.
Fun. It's really good fun, actually. It's nice to be doing that. So it's going to be a while, however, until that's available. We're probably looking at 2023 now, I think. So a bit of a wait, but hopefully worth it. So that's what I'm working on at the moment. And in terms of social media, I am on Twitter as at Nicola Tallis, and I am on Instagram as at Historian Nicola.
Well, Nicola, thank you so much for joining us on Single Malt History today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Nicola Tallis is the author of Uncrowned Queen, The Fateful Life of Margaret Beaufort, Tudor Matriarch, Crown of Blood, The Deadly Inheritance of Lady Jane Grey, and Elizabeth's Rival, The Tumultuous Life of Lettice Knowles, Countess of Leicester. Tune in for our next episode, where I'll be looking at the fascinating life and career of Nur Jahan, the 17th century Persian refugee who became India's first ruling empress. As always, thanks for your time, and I hope you and yours have a great and safe week.